So I'll introduce Lewis. Lewis is almost a founding member of the Perth branch. He's a member of the Social Alternative National Committee, and he is studying zoology. He's going to speak for half an hour or so on the topic of painting our DNA, and then there will be, of course, as usual, time for discussions. So write down any points, etc., that you want to raise in the discussion, and we'll make it very fruitful. Make Lewis feel welcome.
Cool. All right, I'll just start with a piece of interesting trivia to begin with. The Human Genome Project, which I'll call HGP for short, the HGP, is held up by some as an example of the benefits of privatisation and capitalism. Because the research was carried out by both the private and public sectors, the competition between them was supposedly said to promote efficiency and spur on the public researchers to employ new methods in order to keep up. Less often mentioned is how uncooperative, self-serving and money-hungry the corporations involved in the project were. Celera Genomics, the major private researchers involved in the HGP, were happy to incorporate data from the public database GenBank into their own genome. But meanwhile, they refused to deposit the data that they discovered back into the public database. At the same time, Celera filed a preliminary patent application on 6,500 of the genes they discovered. While many saw the Human Genome Project as a new dawn for science and medicine, Celera Genomics saw dollar signs. And I think this is a good starting point for understanding the genetics industry today, the potential medical and other benefits of our newfound knowledge of human genetics are being undermined by the pursuit of profit. It's now 11 years since the completion of the Human Genome Project, the international mission to decode all the DNA information in the human genome. At its inception, the HGP promised to revolutionise medicine. So Daniel Koshland, editor of the leading journal Science, wrote in 1989 of its potential to provide solutions for, and I quote, illnesses such as manic depression, Alzheimer's, schizophrenia and heart disease by uncovering their genetic bases. So fast forward to 2014 and genetic technology is progressing at breakneck speed. The initial Human Genome Project cost $3 billion. By 2007, it cost only $10 million to decode a human genome. By 2011, it cost around $10,000. And today, it costs around $5,000, 1/600,000th of the original cost. And soon, it will cost much less. With access to detailed genetic information, medical professionals will supposedly be able to identify the diseases we're predisposed to and help minimize or prevent their impact through personalized medicine. But the Human Genome Project has not lived up to its promise. Corporate interests and the pursuit of profit have undermined the benefits we should be getting out of the current advances in genetics. There have been attempts to patent our genetic information and restrict access to genetic testing to those who can afford it. And governments have even tried to sell people's genetic information to private corporations. Furthermore, the genetic and environmental causes of many diseases and traits have proved far more complex than previously thought. A pattern of biological reductionism, the idea that human traits can be reduced to simple genetic causes, underpins many of the overblown claims. This same reductionist logic has been used by some to invent simple genetic causes for complex human behaviours such as altruism, homosexuality, women's position in society, nationalism, prejudice against immigrants, and even whether we're on the left or right of the political spectrum. Social biologists have attempted to misuse the data from genome-wide association studies, as they're known, to peddle their reactionary views. And so I'm going to commit a chunk of my talk at the end to talking about biological determinism as well. So before I delve too far into the debates surrounding the Human Genome Project, there's a few ground rules about the Marxist attitude to science that I want to lay out. Science is a product of society, not a quest for eternal truths that exist in a vacuum. Where research funding is directed is determined not by the whims of scientists, but by what's expected to turn a profit. And scientists themselves are not immune from carrying social assumptions and prejudices into their work. This is especially the case when humans or society are the subject of inquiry. So today, for us, eugenics seems like an absurd pseudoscientific justification for racism, but in the 19th and early 20th centuries, it was considered a respectable scientific discipline. Socialists support the advance of scientific knowledge, but we don't uncritically accept whatever scientists say. We critically examine the data to try and disentangle the scientific knowledge from social prejudice. So what's the role that science plays for capitalism? Well, technology and scientific discovery should be a tool of enlightenment which increases our mastery over the laws of nature and improves the lives of all people. The market distorts it into a tool of profit, which increases the mastery of the capitalists over the workers and benefits humanity only incidentally, or at times may in fact be detrimental to society. And this seems like a bold claim, but you can actually observe it in any workplace. For example, in a rational society, an increase in productivity by the introduction of labour-saving technology should benefit everyone. But what does it mean under capitalism? New technology like increased automation in manufacturing or mechanisation and the introduction of cranes on docks has resulted in tens of thousands of jobs lost over the last 50 years. As new technology is introduced, some workers get laid off, some stay on, usually on the same pay, and the bosses reap the profits. So more stuff being produced in factories, more goods being moved through docks, paradoxically results in more people on Centrelink. So this technology, which has the potential to make people's lives easier, instead makes them worse. This is also the case in the genetics industry. Research is carried out for profit, not for the benefit of humanity. So even while the technology has the potential to improve ordinary people's lives, it may not reach this potential. Genetics is one of the main sites of what I like to call evil mastermind capitalism. This is a term that I invented for business models which are legal but are so absurd and immoral by any standards of decency that you think that it must be the plot of a James Bond villain. So there was the case of American corporation Ricetech, which temporarily succeeded in patenting basmati rice, a strain of rice grown in India for hundreds of years, not invented by Ricetech. Or the corporate hate figures Monsanto, who have genetically engineered crops which don't reseed in order to force farmers to continue buying them every year, which people have probably heard of that. Myriad Genetics, who hold patents on variants of the gene BRCA, known as the breast cancer gene, definitely qualify as evil masterminds. The gene variants BRCA1 and BRCA2 dramatically increase chances of developing breast cancer and ovarian cancer. So carriers of BRCA1, which people probably saw in the news, Angelina Jolie was diagnosed with last year, are said to have on average a 65% chance of getting breast cancer. So Myriad's business model was to patent the gene, allowing them a monopoly on diagnostic testing and therefore the ability to charge whatever they wanted. The fee for this potentially life-saving test was $3,000 to $4,000, almost the cost of sequencing an entire genome. But Myriad did not even discover the gene themselves, not in isolation. Six different universities also contributed to the discovery of the genes. And the research linking the gene variants to breast cancer was not funded by Myriad Genetics, it was publicly funded. And how did Myriad repay society? When publicly funded universities and hospitals tried to offer patients cheaper testing for the gene, Myriad forced them to stop by threatening lawsuits, forcing patients to either forego the testing or fork out thousands. So based on forcing women to pay exorbitant fees for a potentially life-saving test for a gene which they did not discover, Myriad made serious money, going from startup in 1994 to a massive company with an annual revenue of $500 million by 2012. And they do run other DNA diagnostics, but the BRCA1 is the major thing that sort of got them going. Now you might be wondering how it's possible to patent a gene, something which occurs in nature. And Myriad had a whole arsenal of different patents under their belt. But the main one was the DNA isolated from the human body, say by diagnostic testing, is chemically different from DNA in its natural state and is therefore patentable material. This is a pretty flimsy argument because the information encoded in their DNA remains the same. But of course, in their legal battles, Myriad didn't rely on this argument, and they never tired of constantly pointing out that gene patents are good for business, which is their sort of overriding concern, as you might guess. Now, fortunately, Myriad's patent was actually overturned in the US Supreme Court in June last year, and this came after years and years of court battles. And this is effectively overturned decades of gene patents. The United States now only allows DNA synthesized in a lab to be patented, which is an important win for our side, I think. But the court decision hasn't stopped Myriad from pursuing legal action against anyone who offers patients BRCA testing using a whole host of other patents covering the method of diagnosis, among other things. And in Australia, Myriad Genetics was granted a patent on the BRCA genes in February last year, which is still being appealed. And so gene patenting is still going on in Australia. So another thing, though, the benefits of genetic diagnoses like this cannot be considered in isolation from broader social questions, specifically the accessibility of healthcare. So even before Myriad took out their patent, even before Myriad took out their patent in the US and jacked up the prices, the breast cancer gene testing still cost about $1,000. For the 27 million women in the United States who lack any healthcare, this is a serious barrier. And even that $1,000 is nothing compared to what the actual preventative treatments would cost. And so there's not much point being diagnosed with a propensity for an illness if you can't afford the preventative treatment. Now I want to turn to looking at why the Human Genome Project hasn't lived up to some of its original claims and to go into some of the science around genetics a little bit. So in the classic Mendelian model of genetics that you learn in school, separate genes encoding for separate traits are passed down independently from each other to an organism's offspring. And so thus there's a clear link between genetic information and observable traits. A single gene variant codes for a single trait and is not influenced by the other traits a person possesses. And so some traits are passed down this way. For example, sickle cell anemia and cystic fibrosis are each caused by a single variation to a specific gene. But it's becoming more and more apparent that most traits are formed by complex, nonlinear interactions between many different genes and the environment. When the Human Genome Project began, estimates for the number of human genes were as high as 2 million, and people thought that there'd sort of be a gene for each trait. Now we're only thought to have around 20,000 genes, about a hundredth of that. So for there to be one gene for each observable trait, it would be impossible. In addition, most traits are linked to multiple genes. So there's thought to be 16 different genes that contribute to eye colour. There are 180 different genes that are associated with height. Of course, our genes don't directly code for observable traits. They code for proteins, which our cells manufacture. But most of our DNA is non-coding, non-coding DNA that has a variety of functions, some of which we don't yet understand. There are even activator and repressor proteins, which basically allow or prevent genes from being translated into proteins, effectively adding them in or cancelling them out of our genetic code. Many traits, so take height as an obvious example, are heavily influenced by environmental factors. So as recently as the 1780s, most Europeans grew to no more than 1.5 meters tall, obviously not because our genetics changed, because we eat more food and stuff now. And of course, geneticists all recognise that most traits have both a genetic and environmental component. The concept of heritability is used to describe the degree to which differences in observed traits are inherited rather than environmental. So heritability of 0 means that differences in a trait are entirely environmental, and a heritability of 1 means that it's entirely genetic. Now, heritability is a useful statistical tool, but especially when we're looking at humans, it's very heavily impacted by what population you've chosen to study, which is an important source of bias in the studies. In addition, there's the problem that's come up of missing heritability. So, for example, type 2 diabetes is thought to have a heritability somewhere between 0.5 and 0.75. But studies have only been able to account for about 6% of this, with no genes being particularly predictive for type 2 diabetes. So in other words, just looking at correlations between single gene variants and rates of diabetes have not brought us much closer to understanding the roots of the disease, which are proving more complex than we thought. Now, if figuring out the genetic basis of an easily quantifiable, concretely defined trait, such as height or diabetes, is so difficult, it's even harder when dealing with complex and often quite ill-defined traits, such as many mental illnesses. So schizophrenia, for example, is a quite broadly defined collection of symptoms with no overriding physiological cause that we have yet positively identified. Two people diagnosed with schizophrenia may not share many symptoms at all. And there are around 120 different genes which may be linked to schizophrenia, but the evidence is pretty shaky. So in 2010, a paper was published linking the CMYA5 gene to schizophrenia. What the study actually showed was that if you have the gene, your chance of being diagnosed with schizophrenia goes up from 1% to 1.07%. So it's not particularly predictive. But meanwhile, having a first-degree relative with schizophrenia increases your chance of diagnosis to 10%, which is far more significant. And without a particular gene being located that causes this. So in my opinion, seeking crude genetic explanations for quite complex and varying illnesses like this is misguided and reductionist and isn't likely to amount to much. I'll just give another example. The prevalence of obesity in Australia has more than doubled in the 20 years leading up to 2013. But there are major research projects underway to try and uncover the genetic causes of obesity. Well, even if obesity has a genetic component, who really cares? We know that the increase must be overwhelmingly due to environmental factors. Our genes haven't radically changed in the last 20 years. So things like providing free healthy meals to school kids or shortening the working day so people had more time for exercise and cooking healthy meals would do wonders to reduce levels of obesity and the associated health complications. Finding the genetic basis, if there is any, seems entirely beside the point. But corporations aren't seeking to solve the problem, they're seeking to make money. And this means finding quick fix solutions that are easily marketed. The Human Genome Project has brought us priceless data on how our genes work, but the claims about a total transformation of medicine now seem much exaggerated in the face of our new knowledge about the complexity of genes, genetic disease, and other human traits. Biological determinist explanations for complex traits, however, have gone well beyond medical applications. In fact, you may be surprised to discover that you're actually at this conference because of your genes. That's right. Rose McDermott, Professor of Political Science at Brown University, has published a review of dozens of papers supposedly proving that your genes influence your political views. She assures us, of course, that this does not just mean Republican or Democrat, but I quote, "the whole political spectrum from conservative to liberal." The fact that in every country in the world except America, the political spectrum goes well outside liberal and conservative seems to be lost on her, proving her incompetence as both a political scientist and an amateur geneticist. One journalist, Thomas Edsel, writing in the New York Times, helpfully pointed out that this genetic information may finally, and I quote again, shed some light on the logic of why some people support abortion while opposing the death penalty. Finally. The sheer hubris of these people, their reduction of politics to what exists in official American politics at this moment in their very small minds is enough to throw out these claims. Over the years, there's also been numerous attempts to find a gay gene. So in 1993, Dean Hummer and others at the National Institutes of Health in the United States claimed to have discovered a genetic basis for human homosexuality. And yet no actual gene has been discovered, only an apparent association between DNA in one part of the genome and male homosexuality in some families. Subsequently, others failed to replicate Hummer's work, and it now seems likely that the original findings were based on flawed statistical analysis, as well as a massive underestimation of the prevalence of homosexuality in society. In February this year, Michael Bailey, a psychologist at Northwestern University in Illinois, announced that his team's study of gay men shows that there are genes involved in male sexual orientation. What the genes actually showed was that there were some similar gene sequences on two chromosomes in a majority of the 400 men tested. As the Guardian's Ian Sample explained, the genes were neither sufficient nor necessary to make any of the men gay. And I doubt this study will amount to much either. In the book Wired for Culture by one Mark Pagel, the author extrapolates in a single page from self-sacrifice in amoeboid slime molds to what he calls a helping gene that codes for an emotion that disposes people to be friendly. And this all sounds quite nice, but as he goes on to tell us, this only extends to people of the same nation. To other national groups, it turns into the jingoism or xenophobia gene. Pagel ends his discussion thus. Next time you feel that warm nationalistic pride at the sound of your national anthem or the news of one of your country's soldiers' valour, think of the amoeba. And this guy, by the way, is Professor of Evolutionary Biology at the University of Reading in the UK. Yep. And then we have the warrior gene, discovered by our friend Rose McDermott, who I mentioned before. In a Dr. Phil segment entitled Born to Rage, with a question mark, McDermott claims that variants of the MAOA gene that make us supposedly more predisposed to physical aggression are present in 30% of the population. It definitely made me more predisposed to physical aggression having to read through all her shit. McDermott's claims were based on a study that she and four colleagues carried out in 2009. The study claimed that MAOAL carriers were more likely than non-carriers to respond with behavioural aggression towards someone they thought had cheated them out of money they earned in a laboratory test. Behavioural aggression was defined as making the putative cheater consume hot sauce. John Horgan, who writes the excellent Scientific American column Crosscheck, says the following. Even disregarding the issue of whether giving someone hot sauce counts as physical aggression, McDermott's study provides little to no evidence for the warrior gene, because the difference between carriers and non-carriers was minuscule. McDermott and others examined 70 subjects, half of whom carried the warrior gene. The researchers found that 75% of the warrior gene carriers meted out aggression when cheated, but so did 62% of the non-carriers. Moreover, when subjects were cheated out of smaller amounts of money, there was no difference. Race has also predictably entered the discussion, if you want to call it that, around the warrior gene. Two researchers at Victoria University in Wellington, Rod Lee and Jeffrey Chambers, report that the warrior gene occurs in 56% of Maori men. This is based on a study of 46 men who needed only one Maori parent to be defined as Maori, meaning obviously they could have got the gene from the other parent. Our researchers helpfully add, it is well recognised that historically Maori were fearless warriors. The debate between this reductionist sociobiology, or nowadays often called evolutionary psychology, and a more sophisticated understanding of human behaviour has been raging for decades. It was personified by the arguments between Richard Dawkins, who wrote The Selfish Gene, who attributes virtually every human characteristic to the gene, or the meme, which is just an idealist version of that, and Stephen Jay Gould, on the other hand, who's an evolutionary biologist and an ardent opponent of sociobiology, who I'm a big fan of. Sociobiology has been given a recent boost by the sheer amount of data now available in the so-called genome-wide association studies, which is basically where you get a group of people, some of whom possess a trait and some of whom don't, and you just look at all their genes and see if you can find a statistical correlation anywhere that correlates with the trait. The typical strategy of the biological determinist was described in Jacobin magazine as follows. Connect mass quantities of sequence data. Find an ill-defined trait, like political preference. Find a gene that is statistically overrepresented in the subpopulation that possesses the trait. Declare victory. Ignore the fact that these genes don't really explain the phenotypic variance of the trait. Instead, claim that if only we had more data, the statistics would all work out. Further generalize these results to the level of societies and claim they explain the fundamental genetic basis of human behavior. Write a press release and wait for the media to write glowing reviews. Repeat with another data set and another trait. And the thing he was trying to get at was that they don't actually propose any molecular mechanism for how these genes supposedly cause these traits. They just find a statistical correlation and publish a paper and leave it at that, which doesn't have much explanatory power. Social biology fails because it is reductionist. Trying to reduce complex human behaviours trying to explain complex human behaviours by reference to our genes is as absurd as trying to explain how a Boeing 747 works by reference to interactions between protons and electrons. The protons and electrons form the basis of how matter works and what atoms the plane is made up of, but to know how it operates, we need to look at aerodynamics, the physics of the jet engine, the combustion of the fuel. We need to look at a higher level of complexity. Similarly, our biology determines how we move, our need to eat and drink, our large brains and opposable thumbs, which make us so adaptable. But complex human behaviours such as xenophobia or nationalism can only be explained by a scientific understanding of the dynamics of our society, capitalism, which is one of the tasks of socialists. So why does this reductionist mode of thinking continue? Well, to answer that, I think we have to turn from biology to politics. Sociobiology takes a common prejudice or assumption about humans and attempts to explain it with a scientific veneer. It conveniently explains away every injustice and inequality as innate, and therefore something we shouldn't bother trying to fix. Never mind if the scientific facts don't hold up to scrutiny, every mainstream news outlet will repeat them anyway. And some scientists who share said prejudices and assumptions will do the same. The medieval priests told the peasant masses that the feudal class system was ordained by God. The priests of sociobiology tell us that xenophobia, war, class inequality, and men's aversion to doing the ironing are ordained by our genes. So just to conclude, science and technology, including genetic technology, holds untold potential for improving the lives of humans. The Human Genome Project has brought advances, but mainly in improving our understanding of the complexity of genetics. These advances are not so easily packaged and marketed as sensationalist announcements about the discovery of a gene coding for this or that trait. For the full benefits of these advances to be recognised, will require a change in the economic basis of our society from one based on profit to one based on human need. Thank you.